Europe is in crisis. All across its member states, an insidious right-wing extremism has become the norm.
Nigel Farage, a man who's tried to dismantle the EU from within, his party could now be one of the largest national parties in this chamber.
Oh, Mr. Orban, thank God there's at least one European leader prepared to stand up for his principles, his nation, his culture and his people. Thank God you're there, is all I can say. Come and join the Brexit Club. You'll love it.
And the liberal centre, so dominant over European politics for decades, has joined in.
All potential illegal economic migrants, wherever you are from, do not come to Europe. It is all for nothing.
But amongst the despair, there are glimmers of hope.
We see that green parties all over Europe are growing, and those issues are becoming much more decisive for people because they see what is happening around them.
I'm convinced much more solidarity is needed. But I also know that solidarity must come from the heart. It cannot be imposed.
So what next for our fragmented continent? Welcome to Saving Europe from Itself, a new series of podcasts from the Another Europe is Possible team. On this programme, we take one big idea from one big thinker and put it through its paces. I'm Luke Cooper, and today I'm hosting with Nick Dearden, who is filling in for Zoe Williams while she's on holiday. On the show, we're joined by campaigner and broadcast journalist Shaista Aziz. Shaista's work has seen her travel all over the world. A former aid worker, she once described the culture in the sector as patriarchy on speed. She shares her lessons on how to fight the power inequalities all around us. Her message to Europe? Get serious about intersectional feminism.
Sweden became the first country in the world in 2014 to champion a feminist foreign policy. Sweden is one of Europe's biggest donors of foreign aid. It is also amongst the top 10 exporters of arms around the world. In 2017, the Canadian government launched its Feminist International Assistance Policy, and to date, 79 countries have adopted national action plans to elevate the role of women in peace and security processes. Women and girls face unprecedented levels of physical and sexual violence from armed militants. Fighting between armed groups and national and international military forces is fueling the mass displacement of people, and the climate crisis is expected to massively accelerate displacement and the creation of refugees. I spent more than 15 years working extensively across the Middle East, East and West Africa and Pakistan as an aid worker. I was working with women and girls impacted by conflict, natural disasters and the climate crisis. In Borno State, northeast Nigeria, I was struck by how young the survivors of rape and forced marriages are. I met children, not even teenagers yet, cradling their own babies, almost certainly the outcome of rape and brutality by their husbands, code for the men who kidnapped them and raped them. The girls and women I met told me that these husbands were Boko Haram fighters. Feminism is a word that is problematic to many women in societies, especially in a non-Western context, as it is Western foreign policy overwhelmingly viewing the lives of black women and women of colour through a white Western and secular lens that has co-opted the language and discourse of feminism to liberate women deemed as other and in need of white Western saviours. Feminist discourse, such as liberating the burqa-clad women of Afghanistan, was co-opted by the British and US governments to help justify the invasion of Afghanistan post 9/11. Fast forward 18 years and more girls are receiving an education in Afghanistan, but war is still raging and women and girls continue to die in childbirth from preventable disease, poverty and gendered violence. The British government is now the biggest supplier of arms to Saudi Arabia. The Saudi-led coalition in Yemen is using indiscriminate and lethal force in densely populated civilian areas, pulverizing hospitals, clinics, schools, and homes. This war is heightening poverty, which leads to a rise in child marriages, devastating the lives of girls. Now more than ever, there is a real need for a feminist foreign policy to be developed by the UK government and its counterparts in Sweden and Norway, two countries leading on this area of work. A true feminist foreign policy has to be rooted in ethics, putting human rights above arms sales profits and safeguarding women's agency and putting women centre stage in developing policies that offer long-term security, justice and economic opportunity to the first victims of failed Western foreign policy, women and girls. Grassroots women's groups are best placed to advocate for the needs of women in the communities they work in. Research shows women are involved in developing and building strategies to reduce conflict, and when they are, this leads to building a sustainable peace. A feminist foreign policy must be bold, otherwise it will remain another political force disproportionately damaging women and girls.
Shaista, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with the ideas, first of all. If you could just explain what's the intersectional element in intersectional feminism, that would be great.
Well, thanks for asking me. So the intersectional element is the key to this, right? So Kimberly Crenshaw is a US academic and a sociologist, and she coined the term intersectional feminism, which was her way of trying to explain what happens in terms of oppression. How does oppression manifest when you have more than one identity? So it's not good enough just to look at women as women. We have to look at race. We have to look at disability. We have to look at class. And when we bring all of these elements in, this is what intersectionality is about. And she actually came up with this concept because she was working with a lot of very disempowered women at the real margins of American society. So we're talking about Latino women, Black women, very working class women who had multiple layers of oppression that they had to navigate through. So that's where this term comes from.
It feels to me that we're going backwards on the issues that you've been talking about, and not just because of armed groups, but when you have elected to power the likes of Bolsonaro, Modi in India, Duterte in the Philippines, and of course the kingpin of them all, Donald Trump in the USA, and that they actually come to power and cement their power through using and utilizing racism and misogyny. This is something I've not seen in my lifetime before, and it's really frightening. And the center's response to this, it seems to me, is just a call neoliberal free market economics feminist. We see this in trade deals, right, where they're talking about feminism chapters in trade deals, which just basically say, look, women are going to benefit from this, therefore it's feminist. We need a completely different approach that I think you've begun to outline, but we're all looking for hope today. Do you see this hope anywhere?
Yeah, we are in a global crisis. I do feel that this is something we've not seen for a very long time. I'm a bit reluctant to say we've never seen anything like this before, but there's an onslaught and it does feel very overwhelming, and it's very deliberate in terms of how these so-called strong men, how they are waging war, and I do think that's the right term to use, against women's rights, against reproductive rights. And it's not just the usual suspects waging these wars, and that's what makes this so horrifying, because there is plenty of pushback. Just to be very clear, we don't always hear about the pushback because many of the people responsible for the pushback are women of colour and Black women and very marginalized women, and we just don't hear about them, but they're there and they're doing the work day in, day out. But yeah, what we're seeing is very deliberate. There is this real belief that if you are a feminist, then you are evil, you are responsible for the world's problems, and you are also responsible for actually creating the regression yourself. So we've seen across Europe, for example, women academics coming under extreme attack. We've seen this in India, as you've already pointed out, Nick, and it's not by accident this is happening. And when you've got the leader of the free world, Donald Trump, who is a misogynist, I don't think we should ever shy away from saying that. When he is busy doing what he's doing, it just gives a very clear signal to everyone else that you can do this too.
My theory would be that part of Trump's rise is a backlash against development that's happening in the global south. I mean, we might not like what that rise actually looks like, say Modi in India, India rising, also an authoritarian, but in some ways the global south is becoming much more powerful. We talk about the G20, not the G7, you know.
I think Trump is a backlash to that, but I think it's a backlash to many things. And I feel very much that what we've got now in global political discourse is entering a zero-sum game. So if I have my rights, that means you can't have your rights. And that would be me as a woman, you as a man, and then everything else, you know, black, disabled, cis, transgender. I think that's where we've got to. And definitely the developing world is becoming more powerful, as it should. And it's because people are asserting their rights. They've had enough. They've had enough of this. And I think a lot of the very brave work that's being done is definitely from the global south. And what we have at the moment is a lot of lecturing and posturing and real attempts to suggest that we have all the answers. Well, we don't. Otherwise, we wouldn't be in this crisis. And what I find is when I'm working a lot with women in the global south, they are really, really organized. They have so much hope. And here in the UK and elsewhere, I feel like hope is beginning to diminish. And partly it's because people do not want to take responsibility for their personal power. And they don't want to take responsibility for what they actually have to do to shift the status quo and to stop what's going on. Meanwhile, in the global south, the women and the allies of women as well, they've been fighting from day one, and they are starting to understand their power, which is why they're also coming under attack as well.
Do you consider the European Union an intersectional and feminist organisation?
Well, absolutely not, sadly. I mean, look at who is in the European Parliament, you know. There was an article fairly recently that came out looking at the lack of representation. There is a fundamental lack of representation, not only of the people generally, but also when you look at who's there, it's majority white privileged men, right? And I think this is another reason why we've got to where we have, because it is such a disconnected source of power, and it's overwhelmingly privileged white elite men with a sprinkling of privileged elite white women. And it just feels so far removed from the day-to-day realities of people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, I have to agree with you. Doing this work over the last few years, I have been to the European Parliament a few times, and I must say, speaking as a white man, is probably one of the whitest places I've ever been. I mean, you don't see any people of colour, and it's confirmed, you know, by the statistics that you just mentioned. You know, I think 4% of the current parliament, just over 4%, are people of colour.
Mm-hmm.
But that will go down to 3% when Britain leaves. So Britain is actually relatively better
for
all of our problems than other states when it comes to representation. And you know, we have 73 MEPs as well. So, you know, it's a huge problem. And in Germany, I found out recently, only elected its first black members of national parliament in 2013. And that's a quarter of a century after Britain.
It's really revealing, isn't it? And then meanwhile, in this country, we've got this kind of manufactured debate about why people of colour should all be celebrating and, you know, high-fiving the new Home Secretary and the new Chancellor based on the fact that they're brown and elite and privileged. So it's a really interesting time, a very disturbing time, because what we've got is the facts that speak really loudly for themselves, which is there's a complete lack of representation in politics, right, here and in Europe. And then we've got the other side, which is like we're supposed to be celebrating people just purely for their race rather than their actual politics. So I keep saying this over and over again, but representation absolutely matters, but it has to be real and it has to be meaningful. And so the current debate in this country is about, you know, well, if you don't like these brown people, if they're to the right, then, you know, you should still celebrate them. And if they were to the left, then perhaps people like me would celebrate them. I'm like, I'm not here to celebrate people just for the colour of their skin, because that's called tokenism. And I'm here to advocate for progressive socialist politics that will really change the lives of people. And these people who are currently in power are disproportionately impacting the lives of the poorest and most vulnerable in our country, who happen to be women and who happen to be black women, and they happen to be minority women and disabled women. And so there's nothing to celebrate as far as I can see.
And this is a reference to, well, a number of media outlets made the point, but the Daily Telegraph in particular celebrated it and claimed to back this up with stats that it was the youngest and most diverse cabinet in British history.
Yeah, well, modern, the most modern. Like, modern's become a like code word for brown. Who knew?
It seems to me that if there's one thing we can be pleased about in Britain, it's that there was a big attempt in the 70s, especially, to really try and come to terms with the empire and the history of that empire, led, of course, by mass movements of people from the countries that were victims of that empire, especially India, Bangladesh and Pakistan in this country. And that means that when you're putting on a museum exhibition or something in this country, you've got to reference this in a way that they don't reference it in other European countries. But I also feel there is a big backlash, a huge backlash over the last 20 years against that very movement.
Yeah.
You know, look at what Michael Gove was trying to do in the education department and trying to reframe the empire, kind of post-revisionism idea of it. But those movements can only come really from the victims of those policies, the people who've suffered oppression. And that means we've got to look in this country at the moment to movements of people of colour, to movements of women. And I wonder whether you feel there is enough strength in those movements, again, to give us hope.
Well, I do think there's strength in those movements, without doubt. But I think those movements are exhausted. Not only do we have to day-to-day live our lives and then deal with those multiple layers of oppression, which are deepening, by the way, and then we keep being told that, no, this is not true, everything is fine, there's level playing field. If you're good enough, you will get to X or Y position. And you need to stop talking about race. Stop talking about race is generally the kind of consensus in this country. So we have to bear in mind that the most oppressed groups are doing the work, but they're also suffering the most horrendous levels of oppression and gaslighting. So we have to stand up for those people in a much more stronger and unapologetic way. And we also have to amplify their voices and we have to work with them. So I'm not for 1 minute saying that it's only people who are oppressed who can lead this movement or do the work. Of course not. We need everybody else on board to be able to actually win. And I do believe we're going to win. And I feel that part of the kind of backlash to all of this is that progress is being made. So you talked about empire. Very few people want to talk about empire. But, you know, we have to focus on the roots of empire and what the politics of empire and the great wealth this country has obtained and link it to Brexit and link it to where we are now, because it is all interlinked. And I'm from Oxford. I was born and raised in Oxford. Oxford is a city that is responsible for a lot of this. If you look at who's passed through the doors of the world famous institution, that is the University of Oxford. But at the same time, we've got really progressive work going on in the city with students, with people who live in the city like myself, grassroots activists, community activists, and also people from the university actually want to do the work. So, for example, Pitt Rivers Museum has been doing a lot of work with activists around decolonizing the museum, and it's very powerful work. And so right now there's an exhibition on, which I'm one of the co-curators of, and it's looking at the refugee camp in Calais, and it's looking at Britain's role in creating refugees and borders. And lo and behold, we're continuing to create borders, we're continuing to create refugees. And we have to connect that back to what you said, Nick, which is back to the history of Britain, which is not past history, because we've never really reconciled with it and we don't actually really understand it, but we have to connect it to what's going on now. It's all interlinked.
So it's really interesting to hear you say that, because my feeling is that a lot of the positive stuff that's happening in the UK is coming from the arts. It's coming from education. I would say in universities, there is more teaching of the empire, of concern about issues of race and also other minorities you mentioned earlier in terms of it being intersectional means. There's much more of that going on, but it's coming from the academics, it's coming from the students, and it's completely in contradiction to the pressure that Michael Gove has put on the national curriculum that Nick mentioned when he was education secretary, which was all about whitewashing the empire. So you have these sort of two different possible directions that are really being fought out over what the actual history of this country is and how we should talk about
it. And that's always been the case, right? So the arts are supposed to be the voice of the people. That's what the arts are supposed to be about. But in the UK, because everything is so class dominated, the arts for many people feel really remote and very foreign, right? But in other parts of the world, that's not the case. But I think we are starting to see a shift taking place there. So if you just look back at Glastonbury from a couple of weeks ago and that incredible headlining set from Stormzy, it was phenomenal. It was phenomenal that out he walked in that Union Jack stab vest. He had ballet dancers on. He had everyone on. You know what he said about Boris Johnson. And it was like, this is the story of a country, of the nation, that the politicians don't want to A, hear, and B, they definitely don't want to tell this story. And this is why the arts are so important, because the arts are about we, the people, getting to tell our stories. And I think a lot of history is about storytelling, and it's about who gets to tell the story, who gets to shape the story, and then how that narrative continues. And there is pushback, and I'm really proud of the fact that in this country we have incredible people pushing back every day. And I think part of this is being fed into the movement to stop Brexit and to also outline very clearly that Lexit is a sham. And I think it's those stories and that activism that is really coming through now. So we do have to be hopeful, because if we're not hopeful, then we can never win. And I genuinely believe we will win. It's going to take time and it's going to be exhausting, and it already is. So we just have to kind of ramp this up.
I wanted to ask a question about the Remain movement, really, because for me, part of the reason I opposed Brexit was always to do with the fact that it seemed clearly it was a reactionary vote that contained big elements of racism, of wanting to go back to empire, and so on and so forth. Of course, that's not to say every single person who voted to leave the European Union is a racist, but structurally, that was for me a core component of that vote. However, the Remain movement has hardly dealt with that by embracing and fighting on that issue. The Remain movement is incredibly white. It's quite male. And even in our bit of the left Remain movement, where I imagine we're all firm anti-imperialists and want to build a very different society and so on, it's still a very white conversation.
Yeah.
So I suppose I wanted to ask you a question on why you think that's happened, but also maybe some advice for those of us who prioritise fighting Brexit as to how we can improve.
So I fully agree with you. And also we have to talk about the racism that manifests amongst minorities as well. So, for example, I heard a young British Pakistani man tell me, I was quite stunned, but he told me that he voted for Brexit because, and I quote, "I want to get the effing polls out." And I was like, wow. And so I had said to him, well, are you serious? He said, yes. And I said, have you seen yourself? Have you looked at yourself in the mirror? He got very agitated with me at that point and said, you're a dictator and you can't tell me how to vote. And I said, no, I'm not a dictator. I'm just asking you a question because your reasons for voting Brexit are deeply racist and very, very problematic. If you told me you voted Brexit because you think the economy is going to get better, no problem. But when you're telling me this, there is a problem. So we have to deal with that as well. And I think a lot of liberals, particularly white liberals, want to gloss over these issues. And I don't think we can gloss over these issues. We never should have glossed over them, but we certainly can't anymore. The Remain movement is undoubtedly what you just described, Nick. Very white, very male. I'm part of the Remain movement. I go on protests, I speak at events. I very rarely see anyone of any minority background in that room. And I wonder why that is, and part of me knows it's because people are tired and exhausted. They don't have the luxury of indulging in these conversations. And for a lot of people, they would use that word indulge. They'd be like, well, we don't have time for this because we're busy trying to earn a crust outside and deal with the massive rampant increase in racism and hate crime. And when we minorities talk about this, people tell us it's all fictional, it's not real. But what we have to do is we have to go out and we have to go and speak to grassroots movements, and then we have to get out of the way and give them the space to lead on the work, and they will do that. But many of them are doing this work day in, day out, but they've not ever been recognised. They have zero resources. They're sick of all their work being co-opted. They're sick of all their ideas being taken. So what we have to do is we have to go and work harder to reach out to people and then give them the space, give them the resources, and get their voices heard. So that's what we have to do.
Could I tag a related question onto that as well? Because I was just wondering, I know that you're a big supporter of Another Europe, thank you, but I was also just wondering if opposing Brexit was ever a difficult decision for you, or was it always easy?
No.
I mean, I know you're like, well, Nick would probably be someone who was Brexit curious at one point. Is that fair?
Well, I think I never opposed Brexit because I love the European Union. You know, I've spent most of my life fighting against a lot of the policies of the European Union. And so from that perspective of simply the question we were being asked, it was difficult. Where I didn't find it so difficult was it seemed very clear what was behind that question and the real meaning of that question for a lot of people in society.
Absolutely. And no, it wasn't difficult at all, because the lead up to this vote, which wasn't 3 years, it's been going on for decades, right? I'm not a big fan of the EU, just to be very clear. I've already outlined the lack of representation and everything else. There's many problems there. But just looking at the trajectory leading up to that vote, it was only going one way. And the day of the actual vote, I went to go and vote with my mum. My background is I'm of Pakistani heritage. And my mum and I were told by a gaggle of people outside the polling station, we need to get the effing immigrants out. Now, these people, we know them because they live in our neighbourhood. And then our neighbours, and I'm laughing just because it's so absurd. And my mum just shot me a look to say, don't say anything. And we kind of just carried on walking and went to vote. And when I came out of the polling station, I was even more clear than I had been in the year, in the run up to the campaign and everything, that this is what we now have to deal with. Open racism, open animosity, the kind of rubbish that my parents had to deal with when they first came to this country in the 50s and 60s, and now it's all out there again. And guess what? It hasn't gone away because the genie's out of the bottle, right? So I had no problem rejecting Brexit at all because I understand what the roots of it are. And as you say, Nick, I do not believe every person who voted Brexit is racist, just to be very clear. I do, however, believe that people need to take responsibility for what Brexit has become.
Maybe you could just flesh out a bit more what the intersectional feminist foreign policy looks in practice. And it would be weird if we didn't mention this in terms of saving Europe from itself. I think the origins of that slogan come from 2015 because it was used in two different contexts, one in Greece, which isn't what I was going to ask you about, and then one on I am going to ask you about the refugee crisis. Mm. Those two crises in 2015 came together, and it's like European Union has such a problem. If it has an intersectional feminist foreign policy in that crisis, what does it look like? And presumably it means there's no crisis.
Well, I think, first of all, it would reframe this so-called refugee crisis as a human rights crisis, and it would acknowledge that the vast majority of the world's refugees are still in the so-called third world. They are in the global south, right? So that's where they are. That's where they've always been. My family are from Pakistan. We've had more than 2 million refugees of Afghan heritage in the country for decades, okay? I'm not telling you they've been treated very well. I'm not suggesting that for one tiny moment, but I'm just saying that's where they are. Palestinian refugees have been living third generation in Lebanon for decades. This is where people are. So let's reframe it, first of all, as a human rights crisis. By calling it a refugee crisis, what happens is Europe gets to securitize the entire issue and make it all about the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, I should say. It makes it all about security, enforcing borders. So an intersectional approach would actually be about looking at the roots of where this crisis has started. People have been running for their lives and drowning in the sea because of our foreign policy. We've been bombing people from the skies for decades and decades. It's not got us anywhere. And now, once upon a time, we were bombing them with multi-billion pound sophisticated bombs. Now we don't actually know what we're bombing them with because gases and all sorts of things are being used. And sometimes we're not even able to determine what they are. So the first thing is to reframe it. The second thing is to ensure that there is a proper, clear analysis of what's going on. If all of these people who were trying to survive were white and Christian and blonde, okay, there would be less hysteria than the fact that they're brown, they're black, a lot of them are Muslim, and they're being killed and their rights are being denied in majority Muslim countries. And again, this is to do with our foreign policy and how things don't work. So the thing is, first of all, reframing it, giving resources to the people who actually know how to do the work. So we're talking about, as I said earlier on, women's groups, women's rights defenders, activists. They know how to do this work. It's about making sure that their voices are heard. It's not just about bringing in people into a room who speak really good English and that diplomats feel comfortable talking to. It's about bringing everyone else into the room. And it's also about connecting the diaspora to the wider policy issues as well, because the diaspora is missing. The only time the diaspora is invited into these rooms is when it's to do with how we're going to improve our security agenda in this country. That's it.
So what's Sweden and Norway doing differently? Because that was interesting in your statement right at the beginning.
Yeah, so Sweden and Norway have openly and unapologetically said they want to create a foreign policy that is feminist. They have a gendered analysis of what's going on. As I said, that doesn't mean that they've got some happy utopia now. I mean, when you're busy selling arms, when you're busy doing dodgy deals with dodgy regimes, it does not mean you can then turn around and say we've got a feminist foreign policy. As you said earlier on, this word feminism is being used to sell everything, primarily handbags from what I've worked out, having walked past the window in Selfridges recently. So, you know, it's all things to all people, isn't it? So we've got to drill down and look at what's going on. But in terms of Sweden and Norway, what they have actually done, and good on them, is put this on the agenda. They put it on the table and they've said, this is what we need. We need to see genuine and real empowerment of women and girls. We need to look at our trade deals. We need to look at who we're selling arms to. So we know infamously Sweden's had a big spat with the Saudi government over its treatment of women, and the Saudi government doesn't like that. So I think those types of very difficult and challenging conversations are starting to be had. But we need to see more action, because any time any government in the world wants to make itself look really liberal, really progressive, it starts talking about women and girls. Here in our own country, not so long ago, we had the government parading Angelina Jolie around. It's like, come on, people, get real. This is not how you create a feminist discourse. This is not how you create feminist foreign policy. It has to be deeper than that.
And that goes to the argument around comic relief, right, as well, and David Lammy earlier on this year.
Extraordinary, wasn't it?
You can't just send somebody, however well-intentioned she might be, to save Africans from themselves, which is still a view I think a lot of people have about our foreign policy.
They do. And the foreign policy, domestic policy, our aid policies, our defence policies, they are entwined, but they're always kind of done in silos. And to be fair, there is some very good progressive work being done by the Foreign Office. I've been invited to some of their conversations and discussions, but it's all done in silos. So they have no power to actually shift things. So what we have to do is we have to bring it together. And the biggest problem is the lack of trust. So over decades of getting things very wrong, there is a fundamental lack of trust. And to be fair, to build it is going to take time, and we don't really have a lot of time. So in the meantime, we have to go and work with those activists on the ground, and we have to shift resources so they can actually get on with the work in a bolder way than we could ever do it ourselves.
That concludes the podcast for those listening on the podcast platforms. The podcast has had a fantastic year, but there's much more to come. To keep it sustainable and to expand, we need your help. That's why we're introducing Extra Time, available for paid-up members of Another Europe Is Possible. To join the campaign, go to anothereurope.org/join. In this week's Extra Time, we'll ask Shyster whether the idea of no platform for fascism can work in the internet era. Thanks to Shyster, and thanks to you for listening. If you've enjoyed today's podcast, please leave us a rating or review on your podcast platform. It makes a huge difference to our ability to reach new listeners. You can also contact us on podcast@anothereurope.org with feedback and suggestions for new content. Hope you enjoyed it, and see you next time.